Simon & Schuster Audio presents The Shining by Stephen King. Read by Campbell Scott.
It was in this apartment also that there stood a gigantic clock of ebony. Its pendulum swung to and fro with a dull, heavy, monotonous clang. And when the hour was to be stricken, there came from the brazen lungs of the clock a sound which was clear and loud and deep and exceedingly musical, but of so peculiar a note and emphasis that at each lapse of an hour the musicians of the orchestra were constrained to pause, to hearken to the sound. And thus the waltzers perforce ceased their evolutions, and there was a brief disconcert of the whole gay company. And while the chimes of the clock yet rang, it was observed that the giddiest grew pale, and the more aged and sedate passed their hands over their brows, as if in confused reverie or meditation. But when the echoes had fully ceased, a light laughter at once pervaded the assembly, and they smiled as if at their own nervousness, and made whispering vows each to the other that the next chiming of the clock should produce in them no similar emotion, and then, after the lapse of 60 minutes, there came yet another chiming of the clock, and then were the same disconcert and tremulousness and meditation as before. But in spite of these things, it was a gay and magnificent revel. E. A. Poe, The Mask of the Red Death. The sleep of reason breeds monsters. Goya. It'll shine when it shines. Folk saying. Part 1. Prefatory Matters. 1. Job Interview. Jack Torrance thought, "Officious little prick." Ullman stood 5'5", and when he moved, it was with the prissy speed that seems to be the exclusive domain of all small, plump men. The part in his hair was exact, and his dark suit was sober but comforting. "I am a man you can bring your problems to," that suit said to the paying customer. To the hired help it spoke more curtly. "This had better be good, you." There was a red carnation in the lapel, perhaps so that no one on the street would mistake Stuart Ullman for the local undertaker. As he listened to Ullman speak, Jack admitted to himself that he probably could not have liked any man on that side of the desk, under the circumstances. Ullman had asked a question he hadn't caught. That was bad. Ullman was the type of man who would file such lapses away in a mental Rolodex for later consideration. "I'm sorry?" "I asked if your wife fully understood what you would be taking on here. And there's your son, of course." He glanced down at the application in front of him. "Daniel? Your wife isn't a bit intimidated by the idea?" "Wendy is an extraordinary woman." "And your son is also extraordinary?" Jack smiled, a big, wide PR smile. "We like to think so, I suppose. He's quite self-reliant for a 5-year-old. No returning smile from Ullman. He slipped Jack's application back into a file. The file went into a drawer. The desktop was now completely bare except for a blotter, a telephone, a tensor lamp, and an in-out basket. Both sides of the in-out were empty, too. Ullman stood up and went to the file cabinet in the corner. "Step around the desk, if you will, Mr. Torrance. We'll look at the hotel floor plans." He brought back 5 large sheets and set them down on the glossy walnut plane of the desk. Jack stood by his shoulder, very much aware of the scent of Ullman's cologne. "All my men wear English leather or they wear nothing at all," came into his mind for no reason at all, and he had to clamp his tongue between his teeth to keep in a bray of laughter. Beyond the wall, faintly, came the sounds of the Overlook Hotel's kitchen, gearing down from lunch. "Top floor," Ullman said briskly. "The attic. Absolutely nothing up there now but bric-a-brac. The Overlook has changed hands several times since World War II, and it seems that each successive manager has put everything they don't want up in the attic. I want rat traps and poison bait sewed around in it. Some of the third-floor chambermaids say they have heard rustling noises. I don't believe it, not for a moment. But there mustn't even be that 1 in 100 chance that a single rat inhabits the Overlook Hotel." Jack, who suspected that every hotel in the world had a rat or two, held his tongue. Of course, you wouldn't allow your son up in the attic under any circumstances. No, Jack said, and flashed the big PR smile again. Humiliating situation. Did this officious little prick actually think he would allow his son to goof around in a rat-trap attic full of junk furniture and God knew what else? Ullman whisked away the attic floor plan and put it on the bottom of the pile. The Overlook has 110 guest quarters, he said in a scholarly voice. 30 of them, all suites, are here on the third floor. 10 in the west wing, including the presidential suite. 10 in the center, 10 more in the east wing. All of them command magnificent views. Could you at least spare the sales talk? But he kept quiet. He needed the job. Ullman put the third floor on the bottom of the pile, and they studied the second floor. 40 rooms, Ullman said. 30 doubles and 10 singles, and on the first floor, 20 of each. Plus 3 linen closets on each floor, and a storeroom which is at the extreme east end of the hotel on the second floor, and the extreme west end on the first. Questions? Jack shook his head. Ullman whisked the second and first floors away. Now, lobby level. Here in the center is the registration desk. Behind it are the offices. The lobby runs for 80 feet in either direction from the desk. Over here in the west wing is the Overlook dining room and the Colorado lounge. The banquet and ballroom facility is in the east wing. Questions? Only about the basement, Jack said. For the winter caretaker, that's the most important level of all. Where the action is, so to speak. Watson will show you all that. The basement floor plan is on the boiler room wall. He frowned impressively, perhaps to show that as manager, he did not concern himself with such mundane aspects of the Overlook's operation as the boiler and the plumbing. Might not be a bad idea to put some traps down there, too. Just a minute. He scrawled a note on a pad he took from his inner coat pocket. Each sheet bore the legend, "From the desk of Stuart Ullman," in bold black script, tore it off, and dropped it into the outbasket. It sat there looking lonesome. The pad disappeared back into Ullman's jacket pocket like the conclusion of a magician's trick. Now you see it, Jackie boy, now you don't. This guy is a real heavyweight. They had resumed their original positions, Ullman behind the desk and Jack in front of it, interviewer and interviewee. Supplicant and reluctant patron. Ullman folded his neat little hands on the desk blotter and looked directly at Jack, a small, balding man in a banker's suit and a quiet gray tie. The flower in his lapel was balanced off by a small lapel pin on the other side. It read simply, "Staff," in small gold letters. "I'll be perfectly frank with you, Mr. Torrance. Albert Shockley is a powerful man with a large interest in the Overlook, which showed a profit this season for the first time in its history. Mr. Shockley also sits on the board of directors, but he is not a hotel man, and he would be the first to admit this. But he has made his wishes in this caretaking matter quite obvious. He wants you hired. I will do so. But if I had been given a free hand in this matter, I would not have taken you on." Jack's hands were clenched tightly in his lap, working against each other, sweating. "Officious little prick. Officious little prick, officious. I don't believe you care much for me, Mr. Torrance. I don't care. Certainly your feelings toward me play no part in my own belief that you are not right for the job. During the season that runs from May 15th to September 30th, the Overlook employs 110 people full-time, one for every room in the hotel, you might say. I don't think many of them like me, and I suspect that some of them think I'm a bit of a bastard. They would be correct in their judgment of my character. I have to be a bit of a bastard to run this hotel in the manner it deserves." He looked at Jack for comment, and Jack flashed the PR smile again, large and insultingly toothy. Ullman said, "The Overlook was built in the years 1907 to 1909. The closest town is Sidewinder, 40 miles east of here over roads that are closed from sometime in late October or November until sometime in April. A man named Robert Townley Watson built it, the grandfather of our present maintenance man. Vanderbilts have stayed here, and Rockefellers, and Astors, and DuPonts. 4 presidents have stayed in the presidential suite: Wilson, Harding, Roosevelt, and Nixon." "I wouldn't be too proud of Harding and Nixon," Jack murmured. Ullman frowned but went on regardless. "It proved too much for Mr. Watson, and he sold the hotel in 1915. It was sold again in 1922, in 1929, in 1936. It stood vacant until the end of World War II, when it was purchased and completely renovated by Horace Derwent, millionaire inventor, pilot, film producer, and entrepreneur.
I know the name, Jack said.
Yes. Everything he touched seemed to turn to gold, except the Overlook. He funneled over $1 million into it before the first post-war guest ever stepped through its doors, turning a decrepit relic into a showplace. It was Derwent who added the Roque court I saw you admiring when you arrived.
Roque?
A British forebear of our croquet, Mr. Torrance. Croquet is bastardized Roque. According to legend, Derwent learned the game from his social secretary and fell completely in love with it. Ours may be the finest Roque court in America.
I wouldn't doubt it, Jack said gravely.
A Roque court, a topiary full of hedge animals out front. What next? A life-sized Uncle Wiggily game behind the equipment shed? He was getting very tired of Mr. Stuart Ullman, but he could see that Ullman wasn't done. Ullman was going to have his say, every last word of it. When he had lost $3 million, Derwent sold it to a group of California investors. Their experience with the Overlook was equally bad, just not hotel people. In 1970, Mr. Shockley and a group of his associates bought the hotel and turned its management over to me. We have also run in the red for several years, but I'm happy to say that the trust of the present owners in me has never wavered. Last year we broke even, and this year the Overlook's accounts were written in black ink for the first time in almost 7 decades. Jack supposed that this fussy little man's pride was justified, and then his original dislike washed over him again in a wave. He said, I see no connection between the Overlook's admittedly colorful history and your feeling that I'm wrong for the post, Mr. Ullman. One reason that the Overlook has lost so much money lies in the depreciation that occurs each winter. It shortens the profit margin a great deal more than you might believe, Mr. Torrance. The winters are fantastically cruel. In order to cope with the problem, I've installed a full-time winter caretaker to run the boiler and to heat different parts of the hotel on a daily rotating basis, to repair breakage as it occurs and to do repairs so the elements can't get a foothold, to be constantly alert to any and every contingency. During our first winter, I hired a family instead of a single man. There was a tragedy, a horrible tragedy. Ullman looked at Jack coolly and appraisingly. I made a mistake. I admit it freely. The man was a drunk. Jack felt a slow, hot grin, the total antithesis of the toothy PR grin, stretch across his mouth.
Is that it? I'm surprised Al didn't tell you. I've retired.
Yes, Mr. Shockley told me you no longer drink. He also told me about your last job, your last position of trust, shall we say? You were teaching English in a Vermont prep school. You lost your temper. I don't believe I need to be any more specific than that. But I do happen to believe that Grady's case has a bearing, and that is why I've brought the matter of your, previous history into the conversation. During the winter of 1970-71, after we had refurbished the Overlook but before our first season, I hired this unfortunate named Delbert Grady. He moved into the quarters you and your wife and son will be sharing. He had a wife and 2 daughters. I had reservations, the main ones being the harshness of the winter season and the fact that the Gradys would be cut off from the outside world for 5 to 6 months.
But that's not really true, is it? There are telephones here and probably a citizens' band radio as well. And the Rocky Mountain National Park is within helicopter range, and surely a piece of ground that big must have a chopper or two.
I wouldn't know about that, Ullman said. The hotel does have a 2-way radio that Mr. Watson will show you, along with a list of the correct frequencies to broadcast on if you need help. The telephone lines between here and Sidewinder are still above ground, and they go down almost every winter at some point or other, and are apt to stay down for 3 weeks to a month and a half. There is a snowmobile in the equipment shed also.
Then the place really isn't cut off.
Mr. Ullman looked pained. Suppose your son or your wife tripped on the stairs and fractured his or her skull, Mr. Torrance. Would you think the place was cut off then?
Jack saw the point. A snowmobile running at top speed could get you down to Sidewinder in 1.5 hours, maybe. A helicopter from the park's rescue service could get up here in 3 hours, under optimum conditions. In a blizzard, it would never even be able to lift off, and you couldn't hope to run a snowmobile at top speed, even if you dared take a seriously injured person out into temperatures that might be 25 below, or 45 below, if you added in the wind chill factor. In the case of Grady, Ullman said, I reasoned much as Mr. Shockley seems to have done in your case. Solitude can be damaging in itself. Better for the man to have his family with him. If there was trouble, I thought, the odds were very high that it would be something less urgent than a fractured skull, or an accident with one of the power tools, or some sort of convulsion. A serious case of the flu, pneumonia, a broken arm, even appendicitis, any of those things would have left enough time. I suspect that what happened came as a result of too much cheap whiskey, of which Grady had laid in a generous supply unbeknownst to me, and a curious condition which the old-timers call cabin fever. Do you know the term? Ullman offered a patronizing little smile, ready to explain as soon as Jack admitted his ignorance, and Jack was happy to respond quickly and crisply. It's a slang term for the claustrophobic reaction that can occur when people are shut in together over long periods of time. The feeling of claustrophobia is externalized as dislike for the people you happen to be shut in with. In extreme cases, it can result in hallucinations and violence. Murder has been done over such minor things as a burned meal, or an argument about whose turn it is to do the dishes. Ullman looked rather nonplussed, which did Jack a world of good. He decided to press a little further, but silently promised Wendy he would stay cool. I suspect you did make a mistake at that. Did he hurt them? He killed them, Mr. Torrance, and then committed suicide. He murdered the little girls with a hatchet, his wife with a shotgun, and himself the same way. His leg was broken. Undoubtedly so drunk he fell downstairs. Ullman spread his hands and looked at Jack self-righteously. Was he a high school graduate? As a matter of fact, he wasn't, Ullman said, a little stiffly. I thought a, shall we say, less imaginative individual would be less susceptible to the rigors, the loneliness.
That was your mistake, Jack said. A stupid man is more prone to cabin fever, just as he's more prone to shoot someone over a card game or commit a spur-of-the-moment robbery. He gets bored. When the snow comes, there's nothing to do but watch TV or play solitaire and cheat when he can't get all the aces out. Nothing to do but bitch at his wife and nag at the kids and drink. It gets hard to sleep because there's nothing to hear, so he drinks himself to sleep and wakes up with a hangover. He gets edgy. And maybe the telephone goes out and the TV aerial blows down and there's nothing to do but think and cheat at solitaire and get edgier and edgier. Finally, boom, boom, boom.
Whereas a more educated man such as yourself?
My wife and I both like to read. I have a play to work on, as Al Shockley probably told you. Danny has his puzzles, his coloring books, and his crystal radio. I plan to teach him to read, and I also want to teach him to snowshoe. Wendy would like to learn how, too. Oh, yes. I think we can keep busy and out of each other's hair if the TV goes on the fritz. He paused. And Al was telling the truth when he told you I no longer drink. I did once, and it got to be serious. But I haven't had so much as a glass of beer in the last 14 months. I don't intend to bring any alcohol up here, and I don't think there will be an opportunity to get any after the snow flies.
In that you would be quite correct, Ullman said. But as long as the three of you are up here, the potential for problems is multiplied. I have told Mr. Shockley this, and he told me he would take the responsibility. Now I've told you, and apparently you are also willing to take the responsibility.
I am.
All right, I'll accept that, since I have little choice. But I would still rather have an unattached college boy taking a year off.
Well, perhaps you'll do.
Now I'll turn you over to Mr. Watson, who will take you through the basement and around the grounds, unless you have further questions?
No, none at all.
Ullman stood. I hope there are no hard feelings, Mr. Torrance. There is nothing personal in the things I have said to you. I only want what's best for the Overlook. It is a great hotel. I want it to stay that way.
No, no hard feelings.
Jack flashed the PR grin again, but he was glad Ullman didn't offer to shake hands. There were hard feelings. All kinds of them.
2. Boulder. She looked out the kitchen window and saw him just sitting there on the curb, not playing with his trucks or the wagon or even the balsa glider that had pleased him so much all the last week since Jack had brought it home. He was just sitting there, watching for their shop-worn VW,
his elbows planted on his thighs and his chin propped in his hands, a 5-year-old kid waiting for his daddy. Wendy suddenly felt bad, almost crying bad. She hung the dish towel over the bar by the sink and went downstairs, buttoning the top 2 buttons of her house dress. Jack and his pride. Hey, no, Al, I don't need an advance. I'm okay for a while. The hallway walls were gouged and marked with crayons, grease pencil, spray paint. The stairs were steep and splintery. The whole building smelled of sour age. And what sort of place was this for Danny, after the small, neat brick house in Stovington? The people living above them on the 3rd floor weren't married, and while that didn't bother her, their constant, rancorous fighting did. It scared her. The guy up there was Tom, and after the bars had closed and they had returned home, the fights would start in earnest. The rest of the week was just a prelim in comparison. The Friday night fights, Jack called them, but it wasn't funny. The woman, her name was Elaine, would at last be reduced to tears and to repeating over and over again, "Don't, Tom, please don't. Please don't," and he would shout at her. Once they had even awakened Danny, and Danny slept like a corpse. The next morning, Jack caught Tom going out and had spoken to him on the sidewalk at some length. Tom started to bluster, and Jack had said something else to him, too quietly for Wendy to hear, and Tom had only shaken his head sullenly and walked away. That had been a week ago, and for a few days things had been better, but since the weekend things had been working back to normal. Excuse me, abnormal. It was bad for the boy. Her sense of grief washed over her again, but she was on the walk now, and she smothered it. Sweeping her dress under her and sitting down on the curb beside him, she said, "What's up, Doc?" He smiled at her, but it was perfunctory. "Hi, Mom." The glider was between his sneakered feet, and she saw that one of the wings had started to splinter. "Want me to see what I can do with that, honey?" Danny had gone back to staring up the street. "No, Dad will fix it." "Your daddy may not be back until supper time, Doc. It's a long drive up into those mountains." "Do you think the bug will break down?" "No, I don't think so." But he had just given her something new to worry about. "Thanks, Danny. I needed that." "Dad said it might," Danny said in a matter-of-fact, almost bored manner. "He said the fuel pump was all shot to shit."
"Don't say that, Danny."
"Fuel pump?" he asked her with honest surprise. She sighed. "No. All shot to shit. Don't say that."
"Why?"
"It's vulgar."
"What's vulgar, Mom?"
"Like when you pick your nose at the table, or pee with the bathroom door open, or saying things like all shot to shit. Shit is a vulgar word. Nice people don't say it."
"Dad says it. When he was looking at the bug motor, he said, 'Christ, this fuel pump's all shot to shit.' Isn't Dad nice?"
"How do you get into these things, Winifred? Do you practice?"
"He's nice, but he's also a grown-up, and he's very careful not to say things like that in front of people who wouldn't understand."
"You mean like Uncle Al?"
"Yes, that's right."
"Can I say it when I'm grown up?"
"I suppose you will, whether I like it or not."
"How old?"
"How does 20 sound, Doc?"
"That's a long time to have to wait."
"I guess it is, but will you try?"
"Okay." He went back to staring up the street. He flexed a little, as if to rise, but the beetle coming was much newer and much brighter red. He relaxed again. She wondered just how hard this move to Colorado had been on Danny. He was close-mouthed about it, but it bothered her to see him spending so much time by himself. In Vermont, 3 of Jack's fellow faculty members had had children about Danny's age, and there had been the preschool, but in this neighborhood there was no one for him to play with. Most of the apartments were occupied by students attending CU, and of the few married couples here on Arapahoe Street, only a tiny percentage had children. She had spotted perhaps a dozen of high school or junior high school age, 3 infants, and that was all.
"Mommy, why did Daddy lose his job?"
She was jolted out of her reverie and floundering for an answer. She and Jack had discussed ways they might handle just such a question from Danny. Ways that had varied from evasion to the plain truth with no varnish on it. But Danny had never asked, not until now, when she was feeling low and least prepared for such a question. Yet he was looking at her, maybe reading the confusion on her face and forming his own ideas about that. She thought that to children, Adult motives and actions must seem as bulking and ominous as dangerous animals seen in the shadows of a dark forest. They were jerked about like puppets, having only the vaguest notions why. The thought brought her dangerously close to tears again, and while she fought them off, she leaned over, picked up the disabled glider, and turned it over in her hands. "Your daddy was coaching the debate team, Danny. Do you remember that?"
"Sure," he said. "Arguments for fun, right?"
"Right." She turned the glider over and over, looking at the trade name, Speedoglide, and the blue star decals on the wings, and found herself telling the exact truth to her son. There was a boy named George Hatfield that Daddy had to cut from the team. That means he wasn't as good as some of the others. George said your daddy cut him because he didn't like him, and not because he wasn't good enough. Then George did a bad thing. I think you know about that.
Was he the one who put holes in our bug's tires?
Yes, he was. It was after school, and your daddy caught him doing it. Now she hesitated again, but there was no question of evasion now. It was reduced to tell the truth or tell a lie.
Your daddy, sometimes he does things he's sorry for later. Sometimes he doesn't think the way he should. That doesn't happen very often, but sometimes it does.
Did he hurt George Hatfield like the time I spilled all his papers?
Sometimes. Danny with his arm in a cast. He does things he's sorry for later.
Wendy blinked her eyes savagely hard, driving her tears all the way back.
Something like that, honey.
Your daddy hit George to make him stop cutting the tires, and George hit his head. Then the men who were in charge of the school said that George couldn't go there anymore, and your daddy couldn't teach there anymore. She stopped, out of words, and waited in dread for the deluge of questions.
Oh, Danny said, and went back to looking up the street. Apparently the subject was closed, if only it could be closed that easily for her.
She stood up. I'm going upstairs for a cup of tea, Doc. Want a couple of cookies and a glass of milk?
I think I'll watch for Dad.
I don't think he'll be home much before 5.
Maybe he'll be early.
Maybe, she agreed.
Maybe he will.
She was halfway up the walk when he called. Mommy?
What, Danny?
Do you want to go and live in that hotel for the winter?
Now, which of 5,000 answers should she give to that one? The way she had felt yesterday, or last night, or this morning? They were all different. They crossed the spectrum from rosy pink to dead black.
She said, "If it's what your father wants, it's what I want."
She paused.
"What about you?"
"I guess I do," he said finally. "Nobody much to play with around here."
"You miss your friends, don't you?"
"Sometimes I miss Scott and Andy, that's about all."
She went back to him and kissed him, rumpled his light-colored hair that was just losing its baby fineness. He was such a solemn little boy, and sometimes she wondered just how he was supposed to survive with her and Jack for parents. The high hopes they had begun with came down to this unpleasant apartment building in a city they didn't know. The image of Danny and his cast rose up before her again. Somebody in the Divine Placement Service had made a mistake, one she sometimes feared could never be corrected, and which only the most innocent bystander could pay for.
"Stay out of the road, Doc," she said, and hugged him tight.
"Sure, Mom."
She went upstairs and into the kitchen. She put on the teapot and laid a couple of Oreos on a plate for Danny, in case he decided to come up while she was lying down. Sitting at the table with her big pottery cup in front of her, she looked out the window at him, still sitting on the curb in his blue jeans and his oversized dark green Stovington prep sweatshirt, the glider now lying beside him. The tears which had threatened all day now came in a cloudburst, and she leaned into the fragrant, curling steam of the tea and wept, in grief and loss for the past and terror of the future.
3. Watson.
"You lost your temper," Ullman had said.
"Okay, here's your furnace,"
Watson said, turning on a light in the dark, musty-smelling room. He was a beefy man with fluffy popcorn hair, white shirt, and dark green chinos. He swung open a small square grating in the furnace's belly, and he and Jack peered in together.
"This here's the pilot light."
A steady blue-white jet, hissing steadily upward, channeled destructive force, But the key word, Jack thought, was destructive and not channeled. If you stuck your hand in there, the barbecue would happen in 3 quick seconds. Lost your temper. Danny, are you all right? The furnace filled the entire room, by far the biggest and oldest Jack had ever seen.
The pilot's got a failsafe, Watson told him. Little sensor in there measures heat. If the heat falls below a certain point, it sets off a buzzer in your quarters.
Boiler's on the other side of the wall. I'll take you around. He slammed the grating shut and led Jack behind the iron bulk of the furnace toward another door. The iron radiated a stuporous heat at them, and for some reason Jack thought of a large, dozing cat. Watson jingled his keys and whistled.
Lost your... When he went back into his study and saw Danny standing there, wearing nothing but his training pants and a grin, a slow red cloud of rage had eclipsed Jack's reason.
It had seemed slow subjectively, inside his head, but it must have all happened in less than a minute. It only seemed slow the way some dreams seem slow, the bad ones. Every door and drawer in his study seemed to have been ransacked in the time he had been gone. Closet, cupboards, the sliding bookcase, every desk drawer yanked out to the stop. His manuscript, the 3-act play he had been slowly developing from a novelette he had written 7 years ago as an undergraduate, was scattered all over the floor. He had been drinking a beer and doing the Act 2 corrections when Wendy said the phone was for him, and Danny had poured the can of beer all over the pages, probably to see it foam. See it foam. See it foam. The words played over and over in his mind, like a single sick chord on an out-of-tune piano, completing the circuit of his rage. He stepped deliberately toward his 3-year-old son, who was looking up at him with that pleased grin, his pleasure at the job of work so successfully and recently completed in Daddy's study. Danny began to say something, and that was when he had grabbed Danny's hand and bent it to make him drop the typewriter eraser and the mechanical pencil he was clenching in it. Danny had cried out a little. No, no, tell the truth, he screamed. It was all hard to remember through the fog of anger, the sick single thump of that one Spike Jones chord. Wendy somewhere, asking what was wrong, her voice faint, damped by the inner mist. This was between the two of them. He had whirled Danny around to spank him, his big adult fingers digging into the scant meat of the boy's forearm, meeting around it in a closed fist. And the snap of the breaking bone had not been loud. Not loud, but it had been very loud. Huge, but not loud. Just enough of a sound to slit through the red fog like an arrow. But instead of letting in sunlight, that sound let in the dark clouds of shame and remorse, the terror, the agonizing convulsion of the spirit. A clean sound, with the past on one side of it and all the future on the other. A sound like a breaking pencil lead or a small piece of kindling when you brought it down over your knee. A moment of utter silence on the other side, in respect to the beginning future maybe, all the rest of his life. Seeing Danny's face drain of color until it was like cheese, seeing his eyes, always large, grow larger still, and glassy. Jack, sure the boy was going to faint dead away into the puddle of beer and papers. His own voice, weak and drunk, slurry, trying to take it all back, to find a way around that not-too-loud sound of bone cracking and into the past. Is there a status quo in the house? Saying, Danny, are you all right? Danny's answering shriek, then Wendy's shocked gasp as she came around them and saw the peculiar angle Danny's forearm had to his elbow. No arm was meant to hang quite that way in a world of normal families. Her own scream as she swept him into her arms and a nonsense babble, oh God, Danny, oh dear God, oh sweet God, your poor sweet arm. And Jack was standing there, stunned and stupid, trying to understand how a thing like this could have happened. He was standing there, and his eyes met the eyes of his wife, and he saw that Wendy hated him. It did not occur to him what the hate might mean in practical terms. It was only later that he realized she might have left him that night, gone to a motel, gotten a divorce lawyer in the morning, or called the police. He saw only that his wife hated him, and he felt staggered by it, all alone. He felt awful. This was what oncoming death felt like. Then she fled for the telephone and dialed the hospital with their screaming boy wedged in the crook of her arm, and Jack did not go after her. He only stood in the ruins of his office, smelling beer and thinking, you lost your temper. He rubbed his hand harshly across his lips and followed Watson into the boiler room. It was humid in here, but it was more than the humidity that brought the sick and slimy sweat onto his brow and stomach and legs. The remembering did that.
It was a total thing that made that night 2 years ago seem like 2 hours ago. There was no lag. It brought the shame and revulsion back, the sense of having no worth at all, and that feeling always made him want to have a drink. And the wanting of a drink brought still blacker despair. Would he ever have an hour, not a week or even a day, mind you, but just one waking hour when the craving for a drink wouldn't surprise him like this? "The boiler," Watson announced. He pulled a red and blue bandana from his back pocket, blew his nose with a decisive honk, and thrust it back out of sight after a short peek into it to see if he had gotten anything interesting. The boiler stood on four cement blocks, a long and cylindrical metal tank, copper jacketed and often patched. It squatted beneath a confusion of pipes and ducts which zigzagged upward into the high, cobweb-festooned basement ceiling. To Jack's right, two large heating pipes came through the wall from the furnace in the adjoining room.
"Pressure gauge is here," Watson tapped it. "Pounds per square inch, PSI. I guess you'd know that. I got her up to 100 now, and the rooms get a little chilly at night. Few guests complain, what the fuck? They're crazy to come up here in September anyway. Besides, this is an old baby. Got more patches on her than a pair of welfare overalls." Out came the bandana. A honk, a peek, back it went. "I got me a fucking cold," Watson said conversationally. "I get one every September. I'd be tinkering down here with this old whore, then I'd be out cutting the grass or raking that rope court. Get a chill and catch a cold, my old mom used to say. God bless her, she'd been dead 6 years. That cancer got her. Once the cancer gets you, you might as well make your will. You'll want to keep your press up to no more than 50, maybe 60. Mr. Ullman, he says to heat the west wing one day, central wing the next, east wing the day after that. Ain't he a crazy man? I hate that little fucker. Yap, 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 all the livelong day, he's just like one of those little dogs that bite you on the ankle, then run around and pee all over the rug. If brains was black powder, he couldn't blow his own nose. It's a pity the things you see when you ain't got a gun. Look here. You open and close these ducts by pulling these rings. I got 'em all marked for you. The blue tags all go to the rooms in the east wing. Red tags is the middle, yellow is the west wing. When you go to heat the west wing, you gotta remember that's the side of the hotel that really catches the weather. When it whoops, those rooms get as cold as a frigid woman with an ice cube up her works. You can run your press all the way to 80 on west wing days. I would, anyway. The thermostats upstairs? Jack began. Watson shook his head vehemently, making his fluffy hair bounce on his skull. They ain't hooked up. They're just there for show. Some of these people from California, they don't think things is right unless they got it hot enough to grow a palm tree in their fucking bedroom. All the heat comes from down here. Gotta watch the press, though. See her creep? He tapped the main dial, which had crept from 100 pounds per square inch to 102, as Watson soliloquized. Jack felt a sudden shiver cross his back in a hurry and thought, the goose just walked over my grave. Then Watson gave the pressure wheel a spin and dumped the boiler off. There was a great hissing, and the needle dropped back to 91. Watson twisted the valve shut, and the hissing died reluctantly.
She creeps, Watson said. You tell that fat little Peckerwood Ullman, he drags out the account books and spends 3 hours showing how he can't afford a new one until 1982. I tell you, this whole place is gonna go sky high someday, and I just hope that fat fuck's here to ride the rocket. God, I wish I could be as charitable as my mother was. She could see the good in everyone. Me, I'm just as mean as a snake with the shingles. What the fuck, a man can't help his nature. Now, you gotta remember to come down here twice a day and once at night before you rack in. You gotta check the press. If you forget, it'll just creep and creep, and like as not, you and your family will wake up on the fucking moon. You just dump her off a little and you'll have no trouble.
What's top end?
Oh, she's rated for 250, but she'd blow long before that now. You couldn't get me to come down and stand next to her when that dial was up to 180.
There's no automatic shutdown?
No, there ain't. This was built before such things were required. Federal government's into everything these days, ain't it? FBI opening mail, CIA bugging the goddamn phones. And look what happened to that Nixon. Wasn't that a sorry sight? But if you just come down here regular and check the press, you'll be fine. And remember to switch those ducts around like you wants. Won't none of the rooms get much above 45 unless we have an amazing warm winter. And you'll have your own apartment just as warm as you like it.
What about the plumbing?
Okay, I was just getting to that. Over here, through this arch.
They walked into a long, rectangular room that seemed to stretch for miles. Watson pulled a cord, and a single 75-watt bulb cast a sickish, swinging glow over the area they were standing in. Straight ahead was the bottom of the elevator shaft, heavy greased cables descending to pulleys 20 feet in diameter, and a huge, grease-clogged motor. Newspapers were everywhere, bundled and banded and boxed. Other cartons were marked records, or invoices, or receipts, save. The smell was yellow and moldy. Some of the cartons were falling apart, spilling yellow, flimsy sheets that might have been 20 years old out onto the floor. Jack stared around, fascinated. The Overlook's entire history might be here, buried in these rotting cartons.
"That elevator's a bitch to keep running," Watson said, jerking his thumb at it. "I know Ullman's buying the state elevator inspector a few fancy dinners to keep the repairman away from that fucker. Now, here's your central plumbing corps." In front of them, 5 large pipes, each of them wrapped in insulation and cinched with steel bands, rose into the shadows and out of sight. Watson pointed to a cobwebby shelf beside the utility shaft. There were a number of greasy rags on it and a loose-leaf binder. "That there is all your plumbing schematics," he said. "I don't think you'll have any trouble with leaks, never has been, but sometimes the pipes freeze up. Only way to stop that is to run the faucets a little bit during the nights. But there's over 400 taps in this fucking palace. That fat fairy upstairs would scream all the way to Denver when he saw the water bill. Ain't that right?" "I'd say that's a remarkably astute analysis." Watson looked at him admiringly. "Say, you really are a college fella, aren't you? Talk just like a book." "I admire that, as long as the fella ain't one of those fairy boys. Lots of them are. You know who stirred up all those college riots a few years ago? The homosexuals, that's who. They get frustrated and have to cut loose. Coming out of the closet, they call it. Holy shit, I don't know what the world's coming to. Now, if she freezes, she's most likely going to freeze right up in this shaft. No heat, you see. If it happens, use this." He reached into a broken orange crate and produced a small gas torch. "You just unstrap the insulation when you find the ice plug and put the heat right to her. Get it?" "Yes, but what if a pipe freezes outside the utility core?" "That won't happen if you're doing your job and keeping the place heated. You can't get to the other pipes anyway. Don't you fret about it. You'll have no trouble. Beastly place down here, cobwebby. Gives me the horrors, it does." "Ullman said the first winter caretaker killed his family and himself." "Yeah, that guy Grady. He was a bad actor, I knew that the minute I saw him. Always grinning like an egg-sucked dog. That was when they were just starting out here, and that fat fuck Ullman, he would have hired the Boston Strangler if he'd have worked for minimum wage. Was a ranger from the National Park that found him. The phone was out, all of them up in the West Wing on the 3rd floor, froze solid. Too bad about the little girls. 8 and 6 they was, cute as cut buttons. Oh, that was a hell of a mess. That Ullman, he manages some honky-tonky resort place down in Florida in the off-season. He caught a plane up to Denver and hired a sleigh to take him up here from Sidewinder because the roads were closed. A sleigh, can you believe that? He about split a gut trying to keep it out of the papers. Did pretty well, I gotta give him that. There was an item in the Denver Post, and of course the obituary in that pissant little rag they have down in Estes Park. But that was just about all. Pretty good considering the reputation this place has got. I expected some reporter would dig it all up again and just sort of put Grady in it as an excuse to rake over the scandals."
"What scandals?"
Watson shrugged. "Any big hotels have got scandals," he said. "Just like every big hotel has got a ghost. Why? Hell, people come and go. Sometimes one of them will pop off in his room, heart attack or stroke or something like that. Hotels are superstitious places. No 13th floor or room 13. No mirrors on the back of the door you come in through, stuff like that. Why, we lost a lady just this last July. Ullman had to take care of that, and you can bet your ass he did. That's what they pay him $22,000 a season for, and as much as I dislike the little prick, he earns it. It's like some people just come here to throw up, and they hire a guy like Ullman to clean up the messes. Here's this woman, must be 60 fucking years old, my age, and her hair's dyed just as red as a whore's stoplight, tits sagging just about down to her belly button on account of she ain't wearing no brassy ear, big varicose veins all up and down her legs so they look like a couple of goddamn road maps, the jewels dripping off her neck and arms and hanging out her ears. She's got this kid with her.
He can't be no more than 17 with hair down to his asshole and his crotch bulging like he stuffed it with the funny pages. So they're here a week, 10 days maybe, and every night it's the same drill. Down in the Colorado lounge from 5 to 7, her sucking up Singapore slings like they're gonna outlaw 'em tomorrow, and him with just the one bottle of Olympia, sucking it, making it last. And she'd be making jokes and saying all these witty things, and every time she said one, he'd grin just like a fucking ape, like she had strings tied to the corners of his mouth. Only after a few days, you could see it was getting harder and harder for him to grin. And God knows what he had to think about to get his pump primed by bedtime. Well, they'd go in for dinner, him walking and her staggering, drunk as a coot, you know, and he'd be pinching the waitresses and grinning at him when she wasn't looking. Hell, we even had bets on how long he'd last. Watson shrugged. Then he comes down one night around 10, saying his wife is indisposed, which meant she was passed out again like every other night they was there, and he's going to get her some stomach medicine. So off he goes in the little Porsche they come in, and that's the last we see of him. Next morning she comes down and tries to put on this big act, but all day she's getting paler and paler, and Mr. Ullman asks her sort of diplomatic-like, would she like him to notify the state cops just in case maybe he had a little accident or something? She's on him like a cat. No, 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 he's a fine driver. She isn't worried. Everything's under control. He'll be back for dinner. So that afternoon she steps into the Colorado around 3 and never has no dinner at all. She goes up to her room around 10:30, and that's the last time anybody saw her alive. What happened? County coroner said she took about 30 sleeping pills on top of all the booze. Her husband showed up the next day, some big-shot lawyer from New York. He gave old Ullman 4 different shades of holy hell. I'll sue this, and I'll sue that, and when I'm through, you won't even be able to find a clean pair of underwear, stuff like that. But Ullman's good, the sucker. Ullman got him quieted down, probably asked that big shot how he'd like to see his wife splashed all over the New York papers. Wife of prominent New York blah blah found dead with belly full of sleeping pills, after playing hide the salami with a kid young enough to be her grandson. The state cops found the Porsche in the back of this all-night burger joint down in Lyons, and Ullman pulled a few strings to get it released to that lawyer. Then both of them ganged up on old Archer Houghton, which is the county coroner, and got him to change the verdict to accidental death, heart attack. Now old Archer's driving a Chrysler. I don't begrudge him. A man's got to take it where he finds it, especially when he starts getting along in years. Out came the bandana. Honk, peek, out of sight. So what happens? About a week later, this stupid cunt of a chambermaid, Dolores Vickery by name, she gives out with a hell of a shriek while she's making up the room where those two stayed, and she faints dead away. When she comes to, she says she's seen the dead woman in the bathroom, laying naked in the tub. Her face was all purple and puffy, she says, and she was grinning at me. So Ullman gave her 2 weeks' worth of walking papers and told her to get lost. I figure there's maybe 40-50 people died in this hotel since my grandfather opened it for business in 1910. He looked shrewdly at Jack. You know how most of them go? Heart attack or stroke while they're banging the lady they're with. That's what these resorts get a lot of, old types that want one last fling. They come up here to the mountains to pretend they're 20 again. Sometimes something gives, and not all the guys who ran this place was as good as Ullman is at keeping it out of the papers. So the Overlook's got a reputation, yeah. I'll bet the fucking Biltmore in New York City has got a reputation if you ask the right people. But no ghosts? Mr. Torrance, I've worked here all my life. I played here when I was a kid no older than your boy in that wallet snapshot you showed me. I never seen a ghost yet. You want to come out back with me? I'll show you the equipment shed. Fine. As Watson reached up to turn off the light, Jack said, there sure are a lot of papers down here. Oh, you're not kidding. Seems like they go back 1,000 years. Newspapers and old invoices and bills of lading and Christ knows what else. My dad used to keep up with them pretty good when we had the old wood-burning furnace, but now they've got all out of hand. Some year I gotta get a boy to haul them down to Sidewinder and burn them, if Ullman will stand the expense. I guess he will if I holler rat loud enough. Then there are rats? Yeah, I guess there's some. I got the traps and the poison Mr. Ullman wants you to use up in the attic and down here. You keep a good eye on your boy, Mr. Torrance. You wouldn't want nothing to happen to him. No, I sure wouldn't. Coming from Watson, the advice didn't sting. They went to the stairs and paused there for a moment while Watson blew his nose again. You'll find all the tools you need out there, and some you don't, I guess. And there's the shingles. Did Ullman tell you about that? Yes, he wants part of the west roof reshingled. He'll get all the for free out of you that he can, the fat little prick, and then whine around in the spring about how you didn't do the job half right. I told him once right to his face, I said. Watson's words faded away to a comforting drone as they mounted the stairs. Jack Torrance looked back over his shoulder once into the impenetrable, musty-smelling darkness and thought that if there was ever a place that should have ghosts, this was it. He thought of Grady, locked in by the soft, implacable snow, going quietly berserk and committing his atrocity. Did they scream? He wondered. Poor Grady, feeling it close in on him more every day, and knowing at last that for him, spring would never come. He shouldn't have been here, and he shouldn't have lost his temper. As he followed Watson through the door, the words echoed back to him like a knell, accompanied by a sharp snap, like a breaking pencil lead. Dear God, he could use a drink, or a thousand of them. 4. Shadowland. Danny weakened and went up for his milk and cookies at 4:15. He gobbled them while looking out the window, then went in to kiss his mother, who was lying down. She suggested that he stay in and watch Sesame Street. The time would pass faster, but he shook his head firmly and went back to his place on the curb. Now it was 5:00, and although he didn't have a watch and couldn't tell time too well anyway, he was aware of passing time by the lengthening of the shadows and by the golden cast that now tinged the afternoon light. Turning the glider over in his hands, he sang under his breath, "Skip to Maloon, I don't care, skip to Maloon, I don't care, my master's gone away, Lulu, skip to Maloo." They had sung that song all together at the Jack and Jill nursery school he had gone to back in Stovington. He didn't go to nursery school out here because Daddy couldn't afford to send him anymore. He knew his mother and father worried about that, worried that it was adding to his loneliness, and even more deeply, unspoken between them, that Danny blamed them. But he didn't really want to go to that old Jack and Jill anymore. It was for babies. He wasn't quite a big kid yet, but he wasn't a baby anymore. Big kids went to the big school and got a hot lunch. First grade, next year. This year was someplace between being a baby and a real kid. It was all right. He did miss Scott and Andy, mostly Scott, but it was still all right. It seemed best to wait alone for whatever might happen next. He understood a great many things about his parents, and he knew that many times they didn't like his understandings, and many other times refused to believe them. But someday they would have to believe. He was content to wait. It was too bad they couldn't believe more, though, especially at times like now. Mommy was lying on her bed in the apartment, just about crying, she was so worried about Daddy. Some of the things she was worried about were too grown up for Danny to understand. Vague things that had to do with security, with Daddy's self-image, feelings of guilt and anger, and the fear of what was to become of them. But the two main things on her mind right now were that Daddy had had a breakdown in the mountains, then why doesn't he call? Or that Daddy had gone off to do the bad thing. Danny knew perfectly well what the bad thing was, since Scotty Aronson, who was 6 months older, had explained it to him. Scotty knew because his daddy did the bad thing, too. Once, Scotty told him, his daddy had punched his mom right in the eye and knocked her down. Finally, Scotty's dad and mom had gotten a divorce over the bad thing. And when Danny had known him, Scotty lived with his mother and only saw his daddy on weekends. The greatest terror of Danny's life was divorce, a word that always appeared in his mind as a sign painted in red letters, which were covered with hissing, poisonous snakes. In divorce, your parents no longer live together. They had a tug of war over you in a court. Tennis court? Badminton court? Danny wasn't sure which, or if it was some other, but Mommy and Daddy had played both tennis and badminton at Stovington, so he assumed it could be either. And you had to go with one of them, and you practically never saw the other one, and the one you were with could marry somebody you didn't even know if the urge came on them. The most terrifying thing about divorce was that he had sensed the word, or concept, or whatever it was that came to him in his understandings, floating around in his own parents' heads, sometimes diffuse and relatively distant, sometimes as thick and obscuring and frightening as thunderheads. It had been that way after Daddy punished him for messing the papers up in his study, and the doctor had to put his arm in a cast. That memory was already faded, but the memory of the divorce thoughts was clear and terrifying. It had mostly been around his mommy that time, and he had been in constant terror that she would pluck the word from her brain and drag it out of her mouth, making it real. Divorce. It was a constant undercurrent in their thoughts, one of the few he could always pick up, like the beat of simple music. But like a beat, the central thought formed only the spine of more complex thoughts, thoughts he could not as yet even begin to interpret. They came to him only as colors and moods. Mommy's divorce thoughts centered around what Daddy had done to his arm and what had happened at Stovington when Daddy lost his job. That boy, that George Hatfield who got pissed off at Daddy and put the holes in their bug's feet. Daddy's divorce thoughts were more complex, colored dark violet and shot through with frightening veins of pure black. He seemed to think they would be better off if he left, that things would stop hurting. His daddy hurt almost all the time, mostly about the bad thing. Danny could almost always pick that up too, Daddy's constant craving to go into a dark place and watch a color TV and eat peanuts out of a bowl and do the bad thing until his brain would be quiet and leave him alone. But this afternoon his mother had no need to worry, and he wished he could go to her and tell her that. The bug had not broken down. Daddy was not off somewhere doing the bad thing. He was almost home now, putt-putting along the highway between Lyons and Boulder. For the moment, his daddy wasn't even thinking about the bad thing. He was thinking about... Danny looked furtively behind him at the kitchen window. Sometimes thinking very hard made something happen to him. It made things, real things, go away. And then he saw things that weren't there. Once, not long after they put the cast on his arm, this had happened at the supper table. They weren't talking much to each other then, but they were thinking. Oh, yes. The thoughts of divorce hung over the kitchen table like a cloud full of black rain, pregnant, ready to burst. It was so bad he couldn't eat. The thought of eating with all that black divorce around made him want to throw up. And because it had seemed desperately important, he had thrown himself fully into concentration, and something had happened. When he came back to real things, he was lying on the floor with beans and mashed potatoes in his lap, and his mommy was holding him and crying, and Daddy had been on the phone. He had been frightened, had tried to explain to them that there was nothing wrong, that this sometimes happened to him when he concentrated on understanding more than what normally came to him. He tried to explain about Tony, who they called his invisible playmate. His father had said, "He's having a hallucination. He seems okay, but I want the doctor to look at him anyway." After the doctor left, Mommy had made him promise to never do that again, to never scare them that way, and Danny had agreed. He was frightened himself, because when he had concentrated his mind, it had flown out to his daddy, and for just a moment, before Tony had appeared, far away as he always did, calling distantly, and the strange things had blotted out their kitchen and the carved roast on the blue plate, for just a moment his own consciousness had plunged through his daddy's darkness to an incomprehensible word much more frightening than divorce, and that word was suicide. Danny had never come across it again in his daddy's mind, and he had certainly not gone looking for it. He didn't care if he never found out exactly what that word meant. But he did like to concentrate, because sometimes Tony would come. Not every time. Sometimes things just got woozy and swimmy for a minute, and then cleared, most times in fact, but at other times Tony would appear at the very limit of his vision, calling distantly and beckoning. It had happened twice since they moved to Boulder, and he remembered how surprised and pleased he had been to find Tony had followed him all the way from Vermont. So all his friends hadn't been left behind after all. The first time he had been out in the backyard and nothing much had happened. Just Tony beckoning and then darkness, and a few minutes later he had come back to real things with a few vague fragments of memory, like a jumbled dream. The second time, 2 weeks ago, had been more interesting. Tony, beckoning, calling from 4 yards over, "Danny, come see." It seemed that he was getting up, then falling into a deep hole, like Alice into Wonderland. Then he had been in the basement of the apartment house, and Tony had been beside him, pointing into the shadows at the trunk his daddy carried all his important papers in, especially the play. "See," Tony had said in his distant, musical voice, "it's under the stairs, right under the stairs."
The movers put it right under the stairs.
Danny had stepped forward to look more closely at this marvel, and then he was falling again, this time out of the backyard swing, where he had been sitting all along. He had gotten the wind knocked out of himself, too. 3 or 4 days later, his daddy had been stomping around, telling Mommy furiously that he had been all over the goddamn basement, and the trunk wasn't there, and he was going to sue the goddamn movers who had left it somewhere between Vermont and Colorado. How was he supposed to be able to finish the play if things like this kept cropping up? Danny said, "No, Daddy, it's under the stairs. The movers put it right under the stairs." Daddy had given him a strange look and had gone down to see. The trunk had been there, just where Tony had shown him. Daddy had taken him aside, had sat him on his lap, and had asked Danny who let him down cellar. Had it been Tom from upstairs? The cellar was dangerous, Daddy said. That was why the landlord kept it locked. If someone was leaving it unlocked, Daddy wanted to know. He was glad to have his papers and his play, but it wouldn't be worth it to him, he said, if Danny fell down the stairs and broke his leg. Danny told his father earnestly that he hadn't been down in the cellar. That door was always locked, and Mommy agreed. Danny never went down in the back hall, she said, because it was damp and dark and spidery, and he didn't tell lies. Then how did you know, Doc? Daddy asked. Tony showed me. His mother and father had exchanged a look over his head. This had happened before from time to time. Because it was frightening, they swept it quickly from their minds. But he knew they worried about Tony, Mommy especially, and he was careful about thinking the way that could make Tony come where she might see. But now he thought she was lying down, not moving about in the kitchen yet, and so he concentrated hard to see if he could understand what Daddy was thinking about. His brow furrowed, and his slightly grimy hands clenched into tight fists on his jeans. He did not close his eyes, that wasn't necessary, but he squinched them down to slits and imagined Daddy's voice, Jack's voice, John Daniel Torrance's voice, deep and steady, sometimes quirking up with amusement or deepening even more with anger, or just staying steady because he was thinking. Thinking of, thinking about, thinking, thinking. Danny sighed quietly, and his body slumped on the curb as if all the muscles had gone out of it. He was fully conscious. He saw the street and the girl and boy walking up the sidewalk on the other side, holding hands because they were in love, so happy about the day and themselves together in the day. He saw autumn leaves blowing along the gutter, yellow cartwheels of irregular shape. He saw the house they were passing and noticed how the roof was covered with shingles. I guess it'll be no problem if the flashing's okay. Yeah, that'll be all right. That Watson, Christ, what a character. Wish there was a place for him in the play. I'll end up with the whole fucking human race in it if I don't watch out. Yeah. Shingles. Are there nails out there? Oh, shit, forgot to ask him. Well, they're simple to get. Sidewinder hardware store. Wasps. They're nesting this time of year. I might want to get one of those bug bombs in case they're there when I rip up the old shingles. New shingles. Old shingles. So that's what he was thinking about. He had gotten the job and was thinking about shingles. Danny didn't know who Watson was, but everything else seemed clear enough. And he might get to see a wasp's nest, just as sure as his name was Danny. Danny. He looked up, and there was Tony, far up the street, standing by a stop sign and waving. Danny, as always, felt a warm burst of pleasure at seeing his old friend. But this time he seemed to feel a prick of fear, too, as if Tony had come with some darkness hidden behind his back, a jar of wasps which, when released, would sting deeply. But there was no question of not going. He slumped further down on the curb, his hands sliding laxly from his thighs and dangling below the fork of his crotch. His chin sank onto his chest. Then there was a dim, painless tug as part of him got up and ran after Tony into funneling darkness. Danny. Now the darkness was shot with swirling whiteness, a coughing, whooping sound, and bending, tortured shadows that resolved themselves into fir trees at night being pushed by a screaming gale. Snow swirled and danced, snow everywhere. "Too deep," Tony said from the darkness, and there was a sadness in his voice that terrified Danny. "Too deep to get out." Another shape, looming, rearing, huge and rectangular, a sloping roof, whiteness that was blurred in the stormy darkness, many windows, a long building with a shingled roof. Some of the shingles were greener, newer. His daddy put them on, with nails from the Sidewinder hardware store. Now the snow was covering the shingles. It was covering everything. A green witch light glowed into being on the front of the building, flickered, and became a giant, grinning skull over two crossed bones.
"Poison," Tony said from the floating darkness. "Poison."
Other signs flickered past his eyes, some in green letters, some of them on boards stuck at leaning angles into the snowdrifts. "No swimming. Danger. Live wires. This property condemned. High voltage. Third rail. Danger of death. Keep off. Keep out. No trespassing. Violators will be shot on sight." He understood none of them completely. He couldn't read, but got a sense of all, and a dreamy terror floated into the dark hollows of his body like light brown spores that would die in sunlight. They faded. Now he was in a room filled with strange furniture, a room that was dark. Snow spattered against the windows like thrown sand. His mouth was dry, his eyes like hot marbles, his heart trip-hammering in his chest. Outside there was a hollow, booming noise like a dreadful door being thrown wide. Footfalls. Across the room was a mirror, and deep down in its silver bubble, a single word appeared in green fire, and that word was Red Rum. The room faded. Another room. He knew, would know, this one. An overturned chair. A broken window with snow swirling in. Already it had frosted the edge of the rug. The drapes had been pulled free and hung on their broken rod at an angle. A low cabinet lying on his face. More hollow booming noises, steady, rhythmic, horrible. Smashing glass, approaching destruction. A hoarse voice, the voice of a madman, made the more terrible by its familiarity.
"Come out! Come out, you little shit! Take your medicine!"
Crash, 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 splintering wood, a bellow of rage and satisfaction. Red Rum. Coming. Drifting across the room, pictures torn off the walls. A record player, Mommy's record player, overturned on the floor. Her records, Grieg, Handel, The Beatles, Art Garfunkel, Bach, Liszt, thrown everywhere. Broken into jagged black pie wedges. A shaft of light coming from another room, the bathroom, harsh white light, and a word flickering on and off in the medicine cabinet mirror like a red eye. Red Rum. Red Rum. Red Rum.
"No," he whispered. "No, Tony, please."
And dangling over the white porcelain lip of the bathtub, a hand. Limp. A slow trickle of blood, Red Rum, trickling down one of the fingers, the third dripping onto the tile from the carefully shaped nail.
"No. Oh, no. Oh, no. Oh, please, Tony, you're scaring me."
Red Rum, Red Rum, Red Rum.
"Stop it, Tony, stop it."
Fading. In the darkness, the booming noises grew louder, louder still, echoing everywhere, all around. And now he was crouched in a dark hallway, crouched on a blue rug with a riot of twisting black shapes woven into its pile, listening to the booming noises approach, and now a shape turned the corner and began to come toward him, lurching, smelling of blood and doom. It had a mallet in one hand, and it was swinging it, Red Rum, from side to side in vicious arcs, slamming it into the walls, cutting the silk wallpaper and knocking out ghostly bursts of plaster dust.
"Come on and take your medicine. Take it like a man."
The shape advancing on him, reeking of that sweet-sour odor, gigantic, the mallet head cutting across the air with a wicked, hissing whisper, then the great hollow boom as it crashed into the wall, sending the dust out in a puff you could smell, dry and itchy. Tiny red eyes glowed in the dark. The monster was upon him. It had discovered him, cowering here with a blank wall at his back, and the trapdoor in the ceiling was locked. Darkness. Drifting.
"Tony, please take me back. Please. Please."
And he was back. Sitting on the curb of Arapaho Street, his shirt sticking damply to his back, his body bathed in sweat. In his ears he could still hear that huge contrapuntal booming sound and smell his own urine as he voided himself in the extremity of his terror. He could see that limp hand dangling over the edge of the tub with blood running down one finger, the third, and that inexplicable word so much more horrible than any of the others, Red Rum. And now, sunshine. Real things. except for Tony, now six blocks up, only a speck, standing on the corner, his voice faint and high and sweet. "Be careful, Doc." Then in the next instant, Tony was gone, and Daddy's battered red bug was turning the corner and chattering up the street, farting blue smoke behind it. Danny was off the curb in a second, waving, jiving from one foot to the other, yelling, "Daddy! Hey, Dad! Hi! Hi!" His daddy swung the VW into the curb, killed the engine, and opened the door. Danny ran toward him and then froze, his eyes widening. His heart crawled up into the middle of his throat and froze solid. Beside his daddy, in the other front seat, was a short-handled mallet, its head clotted with blood and hair. Then it was just a bag of groceries. "Danny, you okay, Doc?" "Yeah, I'm okay." He went to his daddy and buried his face in Daddy's sheepskin-lined denim jacket and hugged him tight, tight, tight. Jack hugged him back, slightly bewildered. "Hey, you don't want to sit in the sun like that, Doc. You're dripping sweat." "I guess I fell asleep a little. I love you, Daddy. I've been waiting." "I love you too, Dan. I brought home some stuff. Think you're big enough to carry it upstairs?" "Sure am." "Doc Torrance, the world's strongest man," Jack said, and ruffled his hair, "whose hobby is falling asleep on street corners." Then they were walking up to the door, and Mommy had come down to the porch to meet them, and he stood on the second step and watched them kiss. They were glad to see each other. Love came out of them the way love had come out of the boy and girl walking up the street and holding hands. Danny was glad. The bag of groceries, just a bag of groceries, crackled in his arms. Everything was all right. Daddy was home. Mommy was loving him. There were no bad things. And not everything Tony showed him always happened. But fear had settled around his heart, deep and dreadful, around his heart and around that indecipherable word he had seen in his spirit's mirror. 5. Phone booth. Jack parked the VW in front of the Rexall in the Table Mesa shopping center and let the engine die. He wondered again if he shouldn't go ahead and get the fuel pump replaced, and told himself again that they couldn't afford it. If the little car could keep running until November, it could retire with full honors anyway. By November, the snow up there in the mountains would be higher than the Beetle's roof, maybe higher than three Beetles stacked on top of each other. "Want you to stay in this car, Doc. I'll bring you a candy bar." "Why can't I come in? I have to make a phone call. It's private stuff." "Is that why you didn't make it at home?" "Check." Wendy had insisted on a phone in spite of their unraveling finances. She had argued that with a small child, especially a boy like Danny, who sometimes suffered from fainting spells, they couldn't afford not to have one. So Jack had forked over the $30 installation fee, bad enough, and a $90 security deposit, which really hurt. And so far the phone had been mute, except for two wrong numbers.
"Can I have a baby Ruth, Daddy?"
"Yes. You sit still and don't play with the gear shift, right?"
"Right. I'll look at the maps."
"You do that." As Jack got out, Danny opened the bug's glove box and took out the five battered gas station maps. Colorado, Nebraska, Utah, Wyoming, New Mexico. He loved road maps, loved to trace where the roads went with his finger. As far as he was concerned, new maps were the best part of moving west. Jack went to the drugstore counter, got Danny's candy bar, a newspaper, and a copy of the October Writer's Digest. He gave the girl a five and asked for his change in quarters. With the silver in his hand, he walked over to the telephone booth by the key-making machine and slipped inside. From here, he could see Danny and the bug through three sets of glass. The boy's head was bent studiously over his maps. Jack felt a wave of nearly desperate love for the boy. The emotion showed on his face as a stony grimness. He supposed he could have made his obligatory thank-you call to Al from home. He certainly wasn't going to say anything Wendy would object to. It was his pride that said no. These days he almost always listened to what his pride told him to do, because along with his wife and son, $600 in a checking account, and one weary 1968 Volkswagen, his pride was all that was left. The only thing that was his. Even the checking account was joint. A year ago he had been teaching English in one of the finest prep schools in New England. There had been friends, although not exactly the same ones he'd had before going on the wagon. Some laughs,
fellow faculty members who admired his deft touch in the classroom and his private dedication to writing. Things had been very good 6 months ago. All at once there was enough money left over at the end of each two-week pay period to start a little savings account. In his drinking days, there had never been a penny left over, even though Al Shockley had stood a great many of the rounds. He and Wendy had begun to talk cautiously about finding a house and making a down payment in a year or so. A farmhouse in the country. Take 6 or 8 years to renovate it completely. What the hell? They were young. They had time. Then he had lost his temper. George Hatfield. The smell of hope had turned to the smell of old leather in Cromart's office. The whole thing like some scene from his own play. The old prints of previous Stovington headmasters on the walls, steel engravings of the school as it had been in 1879 when it was first built, and in 1895, when Vanderbilt money had enabled them to build the field house that still stood at the west end of the soccer field, squat, immense, dressed in ivy. April ivy had been rustling outside Cromart's slit window, and the drowsy sound of steam heat came from the radiator. It was no set, he remembered thinking. It was real. His life. How could he have fucked it up so badly?
This is a serious situation, Jack. Terribly serious. The board has asked me to convey its decision to you.
The board wanted Jack's resignation, and Jack had given it to them. Under different circumstances, he would have gotten tenure that June. What had followed that interview in Cromart's office had been the darkest, most dreadful night of his life. The wanting, the needing to get drunk had never been so bad. His hand shook. He knocked things over, and he kept wanting to take it out on Wendy and Danny. His temper was like a vicious animal on a frayed leash. He had left the house in terror that he might strike them, had ended up outside a bar, and the only thing that had kept him from going in was the knowledge that if he did, Wendy would leave him at last and take Danny with her. He would be dead from the day they left. Instead of going into the bar where dark shadows sat sampling the tasty waters of oblivion, he had gone to Al Shockley's house. The board's vote had been 6-1. Al had been the one. Now he dialed the operator, and she told him that for $1.85 he could be put in touch with Al 2,000 miles away for 3 minutes. Time is relative, baby, he thought, and stuck in 8 quarters. Faintly he could hear the electronic boops and beeps of his connection sniffing its way eastward. Al's father had been Arthur Longley Shockley, the steel baron. He had left his only son, Albert, a fortune, and a huge range of investments and directorships and chairs on various boards. One of these had been on the board of directors for Stovington Preparatory Academy, the old man's favorite charity. Both Arthur and Albert Shockley were alumni, and Al lived in Barry, close enough to take a personal interest in the school's affairs. For several years, Al had been Stovington's tennis coach. Jack and Al had become friends in a completely natural and uncoincidental way. At the many school and faculty functions they attended together, they were always the two drunkest people there. Shockley was separated from his wife, and Jack's own marriage was skidding slowly downhill, although he still loved Wendy and had promised sincerely and frequently to reform, for her sake and for baby Danny's. The two of them went on from many faculty parties, hitting the bars until they closed, then stopping at some mom-and-pop store for a case of beer they would drink parked at the end of some back road. There were mornings when Jack would stumble into their leased house with dawn seeping into the sky and find Wendy and the baby asleep on the couch, Danny always on the inside, a tiny fist curled under the shelf of Wendy's jaw. He would look at them and the self-loathing would back up in his throat in a bitter wave, even stronger than the taste of beer and cigarettes and martinis, Martians, as Al called them. Those were the times that his mind would turn thoughtfully and sanely to the gun, or the rope, or the razor blade. If the bender had occurred on a weeknight, he would sleep for 3 hours, get up, dress, chew 4 Excedrins, and go off to teach his 9 o'clock American poets, still drunk. Good morning, kids. Today the red-eyed wonder is going to tell you about how Longfellow lost his wife in the big fire. He hadn't believed he was an alcoholic, Jack thought, as Al's telephone began ringing in his ear. The classes he had missed or taught unshaven, still reeking of last night's Martians, Not me. I can stop any time. The nights he and Wendy had passed in separate beds. Listen, I'm fine. Mashed fenders. Sure, I'm okay to drive. The tears she always shed in the bathroom. Cautious looks from his colleagues at any party where alcohol was served, even wine. The slowly dawning realization that he was being talked about. The knowledge that he was producing nothing at his Underwood but balls of mostly blank paper that ended up in the wastebasket. He had been something of a catch for Stovington, a slowly blooming American writer, perhaps, and certainly a man well qualified to teach that great mystery, creative writing. He had published 2 dozen short stories. He was working on a play, and thought there might be a novel incubating in some mental back room. But now he was not producing, and his teaching had become erratic. It had finally ended one night less than a month after Jack had broken his son's arm. That, it seemed to him, had ended his marriage. All that remained was for Wendy to gather her will. If her mother hadn't been such a grade-A bitch, he knew, Wendy would have taken a bus back to New Hampshire as soon as Danny had been okay to travel. It was over. It had been a little past midnight. Jack and Al were coming into Barrie on U.S. 31, Al behind the wheel of his Jag, shifting fancily on the curves, sometimes crossing the double yellow line. They were both very drunk. The Martians had landed that night in force. They came around the last curve before the bridge at 70, and there was a kid's bike in the road, and then the sharp, hurt squealing as rubber shredded from the Jag's tires, and Jack remembered seeing Al's face looming over the steering wheel like a round, white moon. Then the jingling, crashing sound as they hit the bike at 40, and it had flown up like a bent and twisted bird, the handlebars striking the windshield, and then it was in the air again, leaving the starred safety glass in front of Jack's bulging eyes. A moment later he heard the final dreadful smash as it landed on the road behind them. Something thumped underneath them as the tires passed over it. The Jag drifted around broadside, Al still jockeying the wheel, and from far away Jack heard himself saying, "Jesus, Al! We ran him down, I felt it!" In his ear, the phone kept ringing. "Come on, Al, be home. Let me get this over with." Al had brought the car to a smoking halt, not more than 3 feet from a bridge stanchion. 2 of the Jag's tires were flat. They had left zigzagging loops of burned rubber for 130 feet. They looked at each other for a moment, and then ran back in the cold darkness. The bike was completely ruined. One wheel was gone, and looking back over his shoulder, Al had seen it lying in the middle of the road, 6 spokes sticking up like piano wire. Al had said hesitantly, "I think that's what we ran over, Jackie boy." "Then where's the kid?" "Did you see a kid?" Jack frowned. It had all happened with such crazy speed. Coming around the corner, the bike looming in the Jag's headlights, Al yelling something, then the collision and the long skid. They moved the bike to one shoulder of the road. Al went back to the Jag and put on its 4-way flashers. For the next 2 hours, they searched the sides of the road, using a powerful 4-cell flashlight. Nothing. Although it was late, several cars passed the beached Jaguar and the 2 men with the bobbing flashlight. None of them stopped. Jack thought later that some queer providence, bent on giving them both a last chance, had kept the cops away, had kept any of the passers-by from calling them. At 2:15, they returned to the Jag, sober but queasy.
"If there was nobody riding it, what was it doing in the middle of the road?" Al demanded. "It wasn't parked on the side, it was right in the fucking middle."
Jack could only shake his head. "Your party does not answer," the operator said. "Would you like me to keep on trying?" "A couple more rings, operator. Do you mind?" "No, sir," the voice said dutifully. "Come on, Al." Al had hiked across the bridge to the nearest payphone, called a bachelor friend and told him it would be worth $50 if the friend would get the Jag snow tires out of the garage and bring them down to the Highway 31 bridge outside of Barrie. The friend showed up 20 minutes later, wearing a pair of jeans and his pajama top. He surveyed the scene.
"Kill anybody?" he asked.
Al was already jacking up the back of the car, and Jack was loosening lug nuts.
"Providentially, no one," Al said.
"I think I'll just head on back anyway. Pay me in the morning."
"Fine," Al said without looking up.
The 2 of them had gotten the tires on without incident, and together they drove back to Al Shockley's house, Al put the Jag in the garage and killed the motor. In the dark quiet, he said, "I'm off drinking, Jackie boy. It's all over. I've slain my last Martian." And now, sweating in this phone booth, it occurred to Jack that he had never doubted Al's ability to carry through. He had driven back to his own house in the VW, with the radio turned up, and some disco group chanted over and over again, "Talismanic" in the house before dawn. Do it anyway. You want to do it. Do it any way you want. No matter how loud, he heard the squealing tires, the crash. When he blinked his eyes shut, he saw that single crushed wheel with its broken spokes pointing at the sky. When he got in, Wendy was asleep on the couch. He looked in Danny's room and Danny was in his crib on his back, sleeping deeply, his arms still buried in the cast. In the softly filtered glow from the streetlight outside, he could see the dark lines on its plastered whiteness where all the doctors and nurses and pediatrics had signed it. It was an accident. He fell down the stairs. Oh, you dirty liar. It was an accident. I lost my temper. You fucking drunken waste. God wiped snot out of his nose and that was you. Listen, hey, come on, please, just an accident. But the last plea was driven away by the image of that bobbing flashlight as they hunted through the dry late November weeds, looking for the sprawled body that by all good rights should have been there, waiting for the police. It didn't matter that Al had been driving. There had been other nights when he had been driving. He pulled the covers up over Danny, went into their bedroom, and took the Spanish Llama 38 down from the top shelf of the closet. It was in a shoebox. He sat on the bed with it for nearly an hour, looking at it, fascinated by its deadly shine. It was dawn when he put it back in the box and put the box back in the closet. That morning he had called Bruckner, the department head, and told him to please post his classes. He had the flu. Bruckner agreed, with less good grace than was common. Jack Torrance had been extremely susceptible to the flu in the last year. Wendy made him scrambled eggs and coffee. They ate in silence. The only sound came from the backyard, where Danny was gleefully running his trucks across the sand pile with his good hand. She went to do the dishes. Her back to him, she said, "Jack, I've been thinking."
"Have you?"
He lit a cigarette with trembling hands. No hangover this morning, oddly enough. Only the shakes. He blinked. In the instant's darkness, the bike flew up against the windshield, starring the glass. The tires shrieked. The flashlight bobbed.
"I want to talk to you about what's best for me and Danny. For you too, maybe. I don't know. We should have talked about it before, I guess."
"Would you do something for me?" he asked, looking at the wavering tip of a cigarette. "Would you do me a favor?" "What?" Her voice was dull and neutral. He looked at her back. "Let's talk about it a week from today. If you still want to." Now she turned to him, her hands lacy with suds, her pretty face pale and disillusioned.
"Jack, promises don't work with you. You just go right on with—"
She stopped, looking in his eyes, fascinated, suddenly uncertain.
"In a week," he said.
His voice had lost all its strength and dropped to a whisper.
"Please, I'm not promising anything. If you still want to talk, then we'll talk about anything you want."
They looked across the sunny kitchen at each other for a long time, and when she turned back to the dishes without saying anything more, he began to shudder.
God, he needed a drink. Just a little pick-me-up to put things in their true perspective.
"Danny said he dreamed you had a car accident," she said abruptly. "He has funny dreams sometimes. He said it this morning when I got him dressed." "Did you, Jack? Did you have an accident?"
"No."
By noon, the craving for a drink had become a low-grade fever. He went to Al's.
"You dry?" Al asked before letting him in.
Al looked horrible.
"Bone dry. You look like Lon Chaney in Phantom of the Opera. Come on in."
They played two-handed whist all afternoon. They didn't drink. A week passed. He and Wendy didn't speak much, but he knew she was watching, not believing. He drank coffee black and endless cans of Coca-Cola. One night he drank a whole six-pack of Coke and then ran into the bathroom and vomited it up. The level of the bottles in the liquor cabinet did not go down. After his classes, he went over to Al Shockley's. She hated Al Shockley worse than she had ever hated anyone. And when he came home, she would swear she smelled scotch or gin on his breath. But he would talk lucidly to her before supper, drink coffee, play with Danny after supper, sharing a Coke with him, read him a bedtime story, then sit and correct themes with cup after cup of black coffee by his hand, and she would have to admit to herself that she had been wrong. Weeks passed, and the unspoken word retreated further from the back of her lips. Jack sensed its retirement, but knew it would never retire completely. Things began to get a little easier. Then, George Hatfield. He had lost his temper again, this time stone sober. "Sir, your party still doesn't—"
"Hello?"
Al's voice, out of breath. "Go ahead," the operator said dourly.
"Al, this is Jack Torrance." "Jackie boy."
Genuine pleasure.
"How are you?"
"Good. I just called to say thanks. I got the job. It's perfect. If I can't finish that goddamn place snowed in all winter, I'll never finish it."
"You'll finish."
"How are things?" Jack asked hesitantly.
"Dry,"
Al responded.
"You?"
"As a bone."
"Miss it much?"
"Every day." Al laughed.
"I know that scene. But I don't know how you stayed dry after that Hatfield thing, Jack. That was above and beyond."
"I really bitched things up for myself," he said evenly.
"Oh, hell, I'll have the board around by spring. Effinger's already saying they might have been too hasty. And if that play comes to something—"
"Yes, listen, my boy's out in the car, Al. He looks like he might be getting restless."
"Sure, understand. You have a good winter up there, Jack. Glad to help."
"Thanks again, Al." He hung up, closed his eyes in the hot booth, and again saw the crashing bike, the bobbing flashlight. There had been a squib in the paper the next day, no more than a space filler, really, but the owner had not been named. Why it had been out there in the night would always be a mystery to them, and perhaps that was as it should be. He went back out to the car and gave Danny his slightly melted baby Ruth. "Daddy?"
"What, Doc?"
Danny hesitated, looking at his father's abstracted face. "When I was waiting for you to come back from that hotel, I had a bad dream, do you remember, when I fell asleep?"
"Mm-hmm." But it was no good. Daddy's mind was someplace else, not with him, thinking about the bad thing again.
"I dreamed that you hurt me, Daddy."
"What was the dream, Doc?"
"Nothing," Danny said as they pulled out into the parking lot. He put the maps back into the glove compartment.
"You sure?"
"Yes." Jack gave his son a faint, troubled glance, and then his mind turned to his play. 6. Night Thoughts. Love was over, and her man was sleeping beside her. Her man. She smiled a little in the darkness, his seed still trickling with slow warmth from between her slightly parted thighs, and her smile was both rueful and pleased, because the phrase, her man, summoned up 100 feelings. Each feeling examined alone was a bewilderment. Together, in this darkness floating to sleep, they were like a distant blues tune heard in an almost deserted nightclub, melancholy but pleasing. "Loving you, baby, is just like rolling off a log. But if I can't be your woman, I sure ain't gonna be your dog." Had that been Billie Holiday? Or someone more prosaic like Peggy Lee? Didn't matter. It was low and torchy, and in the silence of her head it played mellowly, as if issuing from one of those old-fashioned jukeboxes, a Wurlitzer perhaps, half an hour before closing. Now, moving away from her consciousness, she wondered how many beds she had slept in with this man beside her. They had met in college, and had first made love in his apartment. That had been less than 3 months after her mother drove her from the house, told her never to come back, that if she wanted to go somewhere she could go to her father, since she had been responsible for the divorce. That had been in 1970. So long ago. A semester later they had moved in together, had found jobs for the summer, and had kept the apartment when their senior year began. She remembered that bed the most clearly, a big double that sagged in the middle. When they made love, the rusty box spring had counted the beats. That fall she had finally managed to break from her mother. Jack had helped her. "She wants to keep beating you," Jack had said. "The more times you phone her, the more times you crawl back begging forgiveness, the more she can beat you with your father. It's good for her, Wendy.
because she can go on making believe it was your fault. But it's not good for you. They had talked it over again and again in that bed, that year. Jack sitting up with the covers pulled around his waist, a cigarette burning between his fingers, looking her in the eye. He had a half-humorous, half-scowling way of doing that, telling her, "She told you never to come back, right? Never to darken her door again, right? Then why doesn't she hang up the phone when she knows it's you? Why does she only tell you that you can't come in if I'm with you? Because she thinks I might cramp her style a little bit. She wants to keep putting the thumbscrews right to you, baby. You're a fool if you keep letting her do it. She told you never to come back, so why don't you take her at her word? Give it a rest." And at last, she'd seen it his way. It had been Jack's idea to separate for a while, to get perspective on the relationship, he said. She had been afraid he had become interested in someone else. Later she found it wasn't so. They were together again in the spring, and he asked her if she had been to see her father. She had jumped, as if he'd struck her with a quirt. "How did you know that?" "The shadow knows. Have you been spying on me?" And his impatient laughter, which had always made her feel so awkward, as if she were 8 and he was able to see her motivations more clearly than she. "You needed time, Wendy." "For what?" "I guess to see which one of us you wanted to marry." "Jack, what are you saying?" "I think I'm proposing marriage." The wedding. Her father had been there, her mother had not been. She discovered she could live with that, if she had Jack. Then Danny had come, her fine son. That had been the best year, the best bed. After Danny was born, Jack had gotten her a job typing for 6 English department profs. Quizzes, exams, class syllabi, study notes, reading lists. She ended up typing a novel for one of them, a novel that never got published, much to Jack's very irreverent and very private glee. The job was good for 40 a week, and skyrocketed all the way up to 60 during the 2 months she spent typing the unsuccessful novel. They had their first car, a 5-year-old Buick with a baby seat in the middle. Bright, upwardly mobile young marrieds. Danny forced a reconciliation between her and her mother, a reconciliation that was always tense and never happy, but a reconciliation all the same. When she took Danny to the house, she went without Jack. And she didn't tell Jack that her mother always remade Danny's diapers, frowned over his formula, could always spot the accusatory first signs of a rash on the baby's bottom or privates. Her mother never said anything overtly, but the message came through anyway. The price she had begun to pay, and maybe always would, for the reconciliation, was the feeling that she was an inadequate mother. It was her mother's way of keeping the thumbscrews handy. During the days, Wendy would stay home and housewife, feeding Danny his bottles in the sun-washed kitchen of the 4-room, 2-story apartment, playing her records on the battered, portable stereo she had had since high school. Jack would come home at 3, or at 2 if he felt he could cut his last class, and while Danny slept he would lead her into the bedroom, and fears of inadequacy would be erased. At night, while she typed, he would do his writing and his assignments. In those days, she sometimes came out of the bedroom where the typewriter was to find both of them asleep on the studio couch, Jack wearing nothing but his underpants, Danny sprawled comfortably on her husband's chest with his thumb in his mouth. She would put Danny in his crib, then read whatever Jack had written that night before waking him up enough to come to bed. The best bed, the best year. "Sun gonna shine in my backyard someday." In those days, Jack's drinking had still been well in hand. On Saturday nights, a bunch of his fellow students would drop over, and there would be a case of beer and discussions in which she seldom took part because her field had been sociology and his was English. Arguments over whether Pepys' diaries were literature or history. Discussions of Charles Olson's poetry. Sometimes the reading of works in progress. Those and 100 others. No, 1,000. She felt no real urge to take part. It was enough to sit in her rocking chair beside Jack, who sat cross-legged on the floor, one hand holding a beer, the other gently cupping her calf or braceleting her ankle. The competition at UNH had been fierce, and Jack carried an extra burden in his writing. He put in at least an hour at it every night. It was his routine. The Saturday sessions were necessary therapy. They let something out of him that might otherwise have swelled and swelled until he burst. At the end of his grad work, he had landed the job at Stovington, mostly on the strength of his stories, 4 of them published at that time, one of them in Esquire.
She remembered that day clearly enough. It would take more than 3 years to forget it. She had almost thrown the envelope away, thinking it was a subscription offer. Opening it, she had found instead that it was a letter saying that Esquire would like to use Jack's story concerning the black holes early the following year. They would pay $900, not on publication, but on acceptance. That was nearly half a year's take typing papers, and she had flown to the telephone, leaving Danny in his high chair to goggle comically after her, his face lathered with creamed peas and beef puree. Jack had arrived from the university 45 minutes later, the Buick weighted down with 7 friends and a keg of beer. After a ceremonial toast, Wendy also had a glass, although she ordinarily had no taste for beer, Jack had signed the acceptance letter, put it in the return envelope, and went down the block to drop it in the letterbox. When he came back, he stood gravely in the door and said, "Veni, vidi, vici." There were cheers and applause. When the keg was empty at 11 that night, Jack and the only 2 others who were still ambulatory went on to hit a few bars. She had gotten him aside in the downstairs hallway. The other 2 were already out in the car, drunkenly singing the New Hampshire fight song. Jack was down on 1 knee, owlishly fumbling with the lacings of his moccasins. "Jack," she said, "you shouldn't. You can't even tie your shoes, let alone drive." He stood up and put his hands calmly on her shoulders.
"Tonight I could fly to the moon if I wanted to."
"No," she said, "not for all the Esquire stories in the world. I'll be home early." But he hadn't been home until 4 in the morning, stumbling and mumbling his way up the stairs, waking Danny up when he came in. He had tried to soothe the baby and dropped him on the floor. Wendy had rushed out, thinking of what her mother would think if she saw the bruise before she thought of anything else. God help her, God help them both. And then picked Danny up, sat in the rocking chair with him, soothed him. She had been thinking of her mother for most of the 5 hours Jack had been gone, her mother's prophecy that Jack would never come to anything. "Big ideas," her mother had said. "Sure, the welfare lines are full of educated fools with big ideas." Did the Esquire story make her mother wrong or right? "Winifred, you're not holding that baby right. Give him to me." And was she not holding her husband right? Why else would he take his joy out of the house? A helpless kind of terror had risen up in her, and it never occurred to her that he had gone out for reasons that had nothing to do with her.
"Congratulations," she said, rocking Danny. He was almost asleep again. "Maybe you gave him a concussion."
"It's just a bruise." He sounded sulky, wanting to be repentant, a little boy. For an instant she hated him.
"Maybe," she said tightly, "maybe not."
She heard so much of her mother talking to her departed father in her own voice that she was sickened and afraid.
"Like mother, like daughter," Jack muttered.
"Go to bed,"
she cried, her fear coming out sounding like anger.
"Go to bed, you're drunk."
"Don't tell me what to do."
"Jack, please, we shouldn't..." There were no words.
"Don't tell me what to do," he repeated sullenly, and then went into the bedroom.
She was left alone in the rocking chair with Danny, who was sleeping again. 5 minutes later, Jack's snores came floating out to the living room. That had been the first night she had slept on the couch. Now she turned restlessly on the bed, already dozing. Her mind, freed of any linear order by encroaching sleep, floated past the first year at Stovington, past the steadily worsening times that had reached low ebb when her husband had broken Danny's arm, to that morning in the breakfast nook. Danny outside playing trucks in the sandpile, his arm still in the cast. Jack sitting at the table, pallid and grizzled, a cigarette jittering between his fingers. She had decided to ask him for a divorce. She had pondered the question from 100 different angles, had been pondering it, in fact, for the 6 months before the broken arm. She told herself she would have made the decision long ago if it hadn't been for Danny, but not even that was necessarily true. She dreamed on the long nights when Jack was out, and her dreams were always of her mother's face and of her own wedding. "Who giveth this woman?" Her father standing in his best suit, which was none too good. He was a traveling salesman for a line of canned goods that even then was going broke. And his tired face. How old he looked. How pale.
"I do."
Even after the accident, if you could call it an accident, she had not been able to bring it all the way out, to admit that her marriage was a lopsided defeat.
She had waited, dumbly hoping that a miracle would occur and Jack would see what was happening, not only to him but to her. But there had been no slowdown. A drink before going off to the academy, 2 or 3 beers with lunch at the Stovington house, 3 or 4 martinis before dinner, 5 or 6 more while grading papers. The weekends were worse. The nights out with Al Shockley were worse still. She had never dreamed there could be so much pain in a life when there was nothing physically wrong. She hurt all the time. How much of it was her fault? That question haunted her. She felt like her mother, like her father. Sometimes when she felt like herself, she wondered what it would be like for Danny, and she dreaded the day when he grew old enough to lay blame. And she wondered where they would go. She had no doubt her mother would take her in, and no doubt that after a year of watching her diapers remade, Danny's meals recooked and/or redistributed, of coming home to find his clothes changed or his hair cut or the books her mother found unsuitable spirited away to some limbo in the attic, after half a year of that, she would have a complete nervous breakdown, and her mother would pat her hand and say comfortingly, "Although it's not your fault, it's all your own fault. You were never ready. You showed your true colors when you came between your father and me. My father, Danny's father, mine, his. Who giveth this woman? I do." Dead of a heart attack 6 months later. The night before that morning she had lain awake almost until he came in, thinking, coming to her decision. The divorce was necessary, she told herself. Her mother and father didn't belong in the decision. Neither did her feelings of guilt over their marriage, nor her feelings of inadequacy over her own. It was necessary for her son's sake, and for herself, if she was to salvage anything at all from her early adulthood. The handwriting on the wall was brutal, but clear. Her husband was a lush. He had a bad temper, one he could no longer keep wholly under control now that he was drinking so heavily and his writing was going so badly. Accidentally or not accidentally, he had broken Danny's arm. He was going to lose his job, if not this year, then the year after. Already she had noticed the sympathetic looks from the other faculty wives. She told herself that she had stuck with the messy job of her marriage for as long as she could. Now she would have to leave it. Jack could have full visitation rights, and she would want support from him only until she could find something and get on her feet. And that would have to be fairly rapidly because she didn't know how long Jack would be able to pay support money. She would do it with as little bitterness as possible. But it had to end. So thinking, she had fallen off into her own thin and unrestful sleep, haunted by the faces of her own mother and father. "You're nothing but a home wrecker," her mother said. "Who giveth this woman?" the minister said. "I do," her father said. But in the bright and sunny morning, she felt the same. Her back to him, her hands plunged in warm dishwater up to the wrists, she had commenced with the unpleasantness. "I want to talk to you about something that might be best for Danny and I. For you, too, maybe. We should have talked about it before, I guess." And then he had said an odd thing. She had expected to discover his anger, to provoke the bitterness, the recriminations. She had expected a mad dash for the liquor cabinet. But not this soft, almost toneless reply that was so unlike him. It was almost as though the Jack she had lived with for 6 years had never come back last night, as if he had been replaced by some unearthly doppelganger that she would never know or be quite sure of. "Would you do something for me? A favor?" "What?" She had to discipline her voice strictly to keep it from trembling. "Let's talk about it in a week, if you still want to." And she had agreed. It remained unspoken between them. During that week he had seen Al Shockley more than ever, but he came home early, and there was no liquor on his breath. She imagined she smelled it, but knew it wasn't so. Another week. And another. Divorce went back to committee, unvoted on. What had happened? She still wondered, and still had not the slightest idea. The subject was taboo between them. He was like a man who had leaned around a corner and had seen an unexpected monster lying in wait, crouching among the dried bones of its old kills. The liquor remained in the cabinet, but he didn't touch it. She had considered throwing them out 12 times, but in the end always backed away from the idea, as if some unknown charm would be broken by the act. And there was Danny's part in it to consider. If she felt she didn't know her husband, then she was in awe of her child. Awe in the strict meaning of that word, a kind of undefined, superstitious dread. Dozing lightly, the image of the instant of his birth was presented to her. She was again lying on the delivery table, bathed in sweat, her hair in strings, her feet splayed out in the stirrups, and a little high from the gas they kept giving her whiffs of. At one point she had muttered that she felt like an advertisement for gang rape, and the nurse, an old bird who had assisted at the births of enough children to populate a high school, found that extremely funny. The doctor between her legs, the nurse off to one side, arranging instruments and humming. The sharp, glassy pains had been coming at steadily shortening intervals, and several times she had screamed in spite of her shame. Then the doctor told her quite sternly that she must push, and she did. And then she felt something being taken from her. It was a clear and distinct feeling, one she would never forget, the thing taken. Then the doctor held her son up by the legs. She had seen his tiny sex and known he was a boy immediately. And as the doctor groped for the air mask, she had seen something else, something so horrible that she found the strength to scream again, after she had thought all screams were used up. He has no face. But of course there had been a face, Danny's own sweet face, and the caul that had covered it at birth now resided in a small jar which she had kept, almost shamefully. She did not hold with old superstition, but she had kept the caul nevertheless. She did not hold with wives' tales, but the boy had been unusual from the first. She did not believe in second sight, but did Daddy have an accident? I dreamed Daddy had an accident. Something had changed him. She didn't believe it was just her getting ready to ask for a divorce that had done it. Something had happened before that morning. Something that had happened while she slept uneasily. Al Shockley said that nothing had happened, nothing at all, but he had averted his eyes when he said it. And if you believed faculty gossip, Al had also climbed aboard the fabled wagon. Did Daddy have an accident? Maybe a chance collision with fate, surely nothing much more concrete. She had read that day's paper and the next day's with a closer eye than usual, but she saw nothing she could connect with Jack. God help her, she had been looking for a hit-and-run accident, or a barroom brawl that had resulted in serious injuries, or who knew, who wanted to. But no policeman came to call, either to ask questions or with a warrant empowering him to take paint scrapings from the VW's bumpers. Nothing. Only her husband's 180-degree change and her son's sleepy question on waking. Did Daddy have an accident? I dreamed. She had stuck with Jack more for Danny's sake than she would admit in her waking hours, but now, sleeping lightly, she could admit it. Danny had been Jack's for the asking, almost from the first, just as she had been her father's almost from the first. She couldn't remember Danny ever spitting a bottle back on Jack's shirt. Jack could get him to eat after she had given up in disgust, even when Danny was teething and it gave him visible pain to chew. When Danny had a stomachache, she would rock him for an hour before he began to quiet. Jack had only to pick him up, walk twice around the room with him, and Danny would be asleep on Jack's shoulder, his thumb securely corked in his mouth. He hadn't minded changing diapers, even those he called the special deliveries. He sat with Danny for hours on end, bouncing him on his lap, playing finger games with him, making faces at him while Danny poked at his nose and then collapsed with the giggles. He made formulas and administered them faultlessly, getting up every last burp afterward. He would take Danny with him in the car to get the paper, or a bottle of milk, or nails at the hardware store, even when their son was still an infant. He had taken Danny to a Stovington Keen soccer match when Danny was only 6 months old, and Danny had sat motionlessly on his father's lap through the whole game, wrapped in a blanket, a small Stovington pennant clutched in one chubby fist. He loved his mother, but he was his father's boy. And hadn't she felt, time and time again, her son's wordless opposition to the whole idea of divorce? She would be thinking about it in the kitchen, turning it over in her mind as she turned the potatoes for supper over in her hands for the peeler's blade. And she would turn around to see him sitting cross-legged in a kitchen chair, looking at her with eyes that seemed both frightened and accusatory. Walking with him in the park, he would suddenly seize both her hands and say, almost demand,
Do you love me? Do you love Daddy?
And confused, she would nod or say,
Of course I do, honey.
Then he would run to the duck pond, sending them squawking and scared to the other end, flapping their wings in a panic before the small ferocity of his charge, leaving her to stare after him and wonder. There were even times when it seemed that her determination to at least discuss the matter with Jack dissolved, not out of her own weakness, but under the determination of her son's will.
I don't believe such things.
But in sleep she did believe them. And in sleep, with her husband's seed still drying on her thighs, she felt that the three of them had been permanently welded together, that if their three-oneness was to be destroyed, it would not be destroyed by any of them, but from outside. Most of what she believed centered around her love for Jack. She had never stopped loving him, except maybe for that dark period immediately following Danny's accident. And she loved her son. Most of all, she loved them together, walking or riding or only sitting, Jack's large head and Danny's small one poised alertly over the fans of old maid hands, sharing a bottle of Coke, looking at the funnies. She loved having them with her, and she hoped to dear God that this hotel caretaking job Al had gotten for Jack would be the beginning of good times again. And the wind gonna rise up, baby, and blow my blues away. Soft and sweet and mellow, the song came back and lingered, following her down into a deeper sleep, where thought ceased and the faces that came in dreams went unremembered. 7. In another bedroom. Danny awoke with the booming still loud in his ears and the drunk, savagely pettish voice crying hoarsely,
Come out here and take your medicine. I'll find you. I'll find you.
But now the booming was only his racing heart, and the only voice in the night was the faraway sound of a police siren. He lay in bed motionlessly, looking up at the wind-stirred shadows of the leaves on his bedroom ceiling. They twined sinuously together, making shapes like the vines and creepers in a jungle, like patterns woven into the nap of a thick carpet. He was clad in Dr. Denton pajamas, but between the pajama suit and his skin, he had grown a more closely fitting singlet of perspiration.
Tony? He whispered. You there?
No answer. He slipped out of bed and padded silently across to the window and looked out on Arapaho Street, now still and silent. It was 2 in the morning. There was nothing out there but empty sidewalks drifted with fallen leaves, parked cars, and the long-necked streetlight on the corner across from the Cliff Bryce gas station. With its hooded top and motionless stance, the streetlight looked like a monster in a space show. He looked up the street both ways, straining his eyes for Tony's slight, beckoning form. But there was no one there. The wind sighed through the trees, and the fallen leaves rattled up the deserted walks and around the hubcaps of parked cars. It was a faint and sorrowful sound, and the boy thought that he might be the only one in Boulder awake enough to hear it, the only human being, at least. There was no way of knowing what else might be out in the night, slinking hungrily through the shadows, watching and scenting the breeze.
I'll find you. I'll find you.
Tony?
He whispered again, but without much hope. Only the wind spoke back, gusting more strongly this time, scattering leaves across the sloping roof below his window. Some of them slipped into the rain gutter and came to rest there like tired dancers.
Danny! Danny!
He started at the sound of that familiar voice and craned out the window, his small hands on the sill. With the sound of Tony's voice, the whole night seemed to have come silently and secretly alive, whispering even when the wind quieted again and the leaves were still and the shadows had stopped moving. He thought he saw a darker shadow standing by the bus stop a block down, but it was hard to tell if it was a real thing or an eye trick.
Don't go, Danny.
Then the wind gusted again, making him squint, and the shadow by the bus stop was gone, if it had ever been there at all. He stood by his window for a minute, an hour, sometime longer, but there was no more. At last he crept back into his bed and pulled the blankets up, and watched the shadows thrown by the alien streetlight turn into a sinuous jungle filled with flesh-eating plants that wanted only to slip around him, squeeze the life out of him, and drag him down into a blackness where one sinister word flashed in red. Red rum.